Okay, so good morning, everyone, and happy Sunday morning, Fairfax, California, February 3rd, 2019. So really, it's a great opportunity for us to investigate very deeply the interweave of all things, what Thich Nhat Hanh called the interbeing, recognizing very closely here into our tissues, into our heart, that all things are interwoven. And so this morning, as we go into more work with our fascia, our diaphragm, our inner knees, the soles of our feet, all the fascial membranes that are interwoven throughout our body, we're also going to investigate the profound, of course, cornerstone of the Buddha Dharma, which is the notion of interbeing. Really important, because if one doesn't remember interbeing, then one tends to believe that I am separate from everything else. And that, of course, is a great pitfall in the yogic tradition, the belief, the false notion that I'm separate. It's a real pitfall. Really, one falls into the heffalump trap. Do you remember from the 100-acre wood? This is like kind of like the 100-acre wood out here. And you've got Eeyore, probably some Eeyores around here, and some Tiggers. And you know that there's that heffalump trap. And, of course, you know, there really is no heffalump, but it's possible to fall into the trap of thinking, well, I'm separate from everything else. And we live in a time where people feel great isolation, maybe now more than ever in the era of the screen, that people experience isolation. We feel alone. It's kind of an irony in a way that the more possible connections can be made, that the more we end up feeling alone, which is perhaps why the rate of suicide is higher now than ever. And so the experience of separation, of course, is the project that yogis have undertaken from really the first century. This project of the false notion that I'm separate. And so yoga, as you well know, means to yoke or to come together. That is the experience of unity. And so really we will practice today, we'll reflect today on how things are never separate. There is a weave. There's a weave that holds us all together. Chief Seattle once wrote in the early 1800s, man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand. Whatever he or she does to the web, he must do to himself. And so we didn't create this weave. We're part of it. We're born into it. And if you're born into a family, there's a weave that's already there. The fabric's been actually woven, strands of that fabric have been woven for generations and generations prior to us. And then we enter in, we come down the hatch, and we enter in, we're birthed into this weave. And then we create a weave if we have a family or we have a career or we write a book or we teach school or we, you know, whatever we might do, then we're further part of the weave. And so what we do really in this practice is we roll up our sleeves and we work more fearlessly for the benefit of the weave, in support of the weave. That we realize actually that the weave is quite delicate, the ecosystems around us, the creepy crawlies and the small plants and the banana slugs. I saw a banana slug just the other day, and it was quite marvelous. I was like, oh my gosh, what a creature this is. And, you know, and its pace, it moves slower than a snail. I think if you had a race between a banana slug and a snail, I think banana slug come in second. So slow. But how delicate all creatures are. The ecosystem, very, very delicate. Not only inside our body, the weave of our fascia, the way your spleen, stomach, pancreas, liver, gallbladder, thyroid, parathyroid, pituitary, how everything is woven is also a delicate balance. So whether it's inside or outside, the weave is delicate. Which is why we're in service of supporting the weave. You don't tear it up. And that's a good lesson to give to the next group coming in. Our 16-year-olds is, look, we're in service of the weave. Okay? And so in the northern New Mexico where I live, near the Arizona border, there's a long history of weaving. The weavers, the Navajo peoples, it's really the way they expressed all of their relations was by the weaving. The women particularly would weave, and it's a fantastic history of basket making and rug making in the native tradition. Is that suggests, the act of weaving suggests the interbeing of all things. And so it is in the Vedic tradition. There's some beautiful passages that refer to weaving. The warp and the woof. Woof? Weft. Weft, not to be confused with woof. Warp and woof, warp and weft. You have the weft and the warp. I know nothing about this, but I think it's kind of when you weave, you have two, isn't it? They have a horizontal and you have a vertical, and then you thread it through like that. And that's how it is in the body. We have the vertical axis. That suggests pure spirit, of course. The vertical axis, you know, like in this building, it would be, you know, right in the center, like straight up through the sahasra. I don't know if they were thinking of the chakras when they designed this space, but that's the plumb of the, I'm sure they were, of the architecturally, and that represents spirit. And then the horizontal represents all beings. This world, the phenomenal world, is the horizontal. And so the masculine is the vertical, the feminine is the horizontal, the absolute is the vertical, the relative is the horizontal. And so anyhow, then we weave them together, right? In the warp and the woof, weft. Then we weave them together, and that's the kind of matrix that we live in, is we're part spirit and part just physical matter, just we're part mundane, we're part, you know, sublime. We have a sublime side, and we also have a messy side, a side that's always a little chaotic, a little out of balance. And so how can we weave together, you know, our spirit and our ordinary? It's called in Zen tradition the meeting of the ordinary and the extraordinary. And so all things are interwoven. And of course, in the yogic teaching, there's a really interesting notion. When I go back to it over the years, it's always really astonishing to me. There's this idea that the very most interior of the body, along the spine, within the spine, is essentially separate from all of the fluctuating moods and fluctuating states and the back and forward changeability of this world around us. That the central channel is like this idea of the center of this space that we're in this morning is the unconditioned, the unconfined, or that which is the non-dual, it's said, the non-dual. And that channel, it really has its pyramidal peak right at the top of the brainstem, behind the bridge of the nose, the plexus of the sphenoid, the ethmoid bone, very delicate bones, super delicate bones, like as light as a sparrow's beak, the bones right between the eyes. And so back there is the top of the spinal column. And so that's really the abode of the non-dual. But when we're in the world of duality, which we are in every day, just to get here this morning, get your key into your ignition and get out your door and sort of figure out, you know, how to get on Sir Francis Drake. It's like you had to be in the world of the dual world. That's that, and the dual world, we have to remember, is always operates through a kind of binary. It's just the nature of the dual world. You know, it comes about by way of its opposite. That's how we make sense of things. That's how our mind makes sense of things. And I always remember when I was a kid, I was 7 years old, and I would lean back in the leather chair in our den, and I would watch Sesame Street, Ernie and Bert, and Grover. Is it Grover? Is he the one that lived in the trash can? That was Oscar. And Big Bird. And then I remember it was like there was like a banana and an orange like bouncing across the screen. I was like, there's like a little, you know, 7-year-old just sort of watching. You know, there goes the banana and the orange bouncing. And then the little ditty was, you know, one of these things is not like the other. One of these things is just not the same. Something like that, you know? Such a great show, Sesame Street. Oh, that's part of my dharmic history, is learning from Sesame Street, you know? And so we learn at a young age to say, well, this is not that. You know, that this is separate from that. And then our minds become, over time, that's how we perceive the world through our sense gates, is, oh, this is not that. That is not this. And then we can delineate. It's a good thing to learn how to do, to train your nervous system, your brain, to be able to delineate. And we do that when we press out through the inner heel versus the outer heel. Or we differentiate the inner hip from the outer hip, or the inside shoulder blade from the outside shoulder blade, or the right side of the perineum from the left side of the perineum, as we did, I think, on Friday night. And you can delineate form in all kinds of ways. The Indian mind is really kind of like an engineering mind, and the ancients mapped out the stars. And they mapped out time through vast swaths of periods that they identified as yugas or eons, millions of years long. And so really the Sanskrit is really a whole series of very carefully delineated linguistic forms that can combine and recombine. And anyhow, so that's how our mind works, starting with a banana and the orange hopping across the screen as we start to make a split. And then we realize we start, you know, we get to the cushion and we put our sitting bones down and we start working with our breath and our central channel, and that there's a possibility to experience a state beyond the splitting, outside of the splitting phenomena. And when we do that, when we rest in no thought and spaciousness and silence, then we experience something really vast, something really profound. It's always the sister to the world of form. It's the absolute and the relative. So if they're always woven together, like the warp and the weft. And so we oftentimes get so caught up in the world of delineation and the world of form, we forget that we're also made of spirit, that there's a part of us that is spacious. And we, of course, visit that every night when we sleep. One of the greatest yogic practices is done every night for hopefully at least 7 hours, 8 hours. Maybe you have a power sleep, 10-hour sleep. You know, really, that's when we rest for some period of time where we're not delineating. Although there are two phases of sleep. There's REM sleep and there's non-REM sleep. And in the REM sleep, the brain continues to produce images. It really pulls from the world of cause and effect, pulls from the experiential world, and then reconfigures through dream images and somatic feeling. So that's REM sleep. The non-REM sleep is particularly healing. It's where we're just resting in open space and without much oscillation at all within our nervous system. And so the yogis, of course, identified four states of consciousness: waking, sleeping with dream, sleeping without dream, and then the wakeful state that's very much like sleep, where one's awake but completely at rest. Very deep shamatha, very deep rest. So anyhow, when you sleep, we all spend time in a kind of samadhi every night, hopefully, although we're also a culture of sleepless. As a culture, we suffer from sleeplessness, and that can, it's hard for the body to heal when we don't sleep very well. So sleep is a kind of samadhi, and we try to recreate sleep-like states when we practice. Gives the nervous chance an opportunity to rest. Really, it's just like, you know, shutting your computer and letting all your hardware rest. So we learn how to do that in sitting practice and shavasana practice, to really drop into places of deep rest. But when we're in the world of form, we realize, oh, it's always about a kind of delineation of like, this is male and female, dark and light, cloud and ridge. And there's a beautiful passage on the back side of the card that's the handout for the weekend from the Japanese poet Zan Oku, who once wrote, "May the flowers remind us why the rain was so necessary." Beautiful for this weekend is that always things are conditioned in the world of form, and that the rains condition the flowers, just as your liver conditions your blood, and how our sensory gates condition our mind. Experiences that we have through our sensory gates, eyes, taste, touch, hearing, condition our brain. Our brain is really nothing without the input of the senses. There's another really beautiful little passage from the founder of the Soto School of Zen Buddhism, Zen Master Dogen. You can still visit the Heiji Temple outside of Kyoto today, where Dogen taught for many years. And he wrote, "All my life, false and real. All my life, false and real, right and wrong tangled. Playing with the moon, ridiculing wind, listening to birds. Many years wasted, seeing the mountain covered with snow. This winter, I suddenly realize snow makes a mountain." all my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled. Oftentimes we get in sort of to an entanglement as we create separation. We're in this country in many ways as we debate about whether we're going to build a wall around, fortify ourselves. We get caught in all kinds of ways. We get caught up in splitting, separating out. So all my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled up. And then suddenly he has this view of, wait a minute, it's always that way. There's always, things are always relative. It's the world of the relative, the interdependent. That suddenly I realize this winter snow makes a mountain, just as fog makes the ridge, or inhalation makes exhalation, father makes son, or our sangha that comes together is made by good intention. So really, that's the way of the world, is that things are always in a kind of opposition or a kind of, you know, relationship. And so we're in service of that. As the native people said, you know, all my relations I'm in service of. And that's the way we live our lives. We're always experiencing snow on mountain, mountain covered by snow, rain making flowers. So once we realize that, we roll up our sleeves and we just live in the world of the relative, with the precepts, with the yamas, the intention to be in service of the weave. There's no yoga without yama. We are in service of the weave. And then it's like, okay, I can be in the weave this way. Oh, maybe this is happening today. I'm in this conversation. Oh, I'm in this kind of entanglement. I'm not going to feel like, oh, this is the end of my world because I'm getting in this part of the tangle. Like, oh no, I should go back into my house and back into my closet and, you know, ward myself off. No, we're always in relationship, and relationship is always changing. And so we have the fortitude, the courage to live a life, to live fully in the world of relative, in the relative world, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, painful or sublime. You don't have to pull away from the weave. We're always in the weave. We're never other than the weave. Okay, so we've been investigating connective tissue, the weave of the inner tissues that support our bones, our organs, our glands. Now we're talking in a more broad way, universal way, talking about the Buddhaverse, how in the Buddhaverse all things are woven together. They always have been, they always will be, and we're part of it. So may I fearlessly, fearlessly live part of the weave.